At times, the chase would end in strange coverts. There was the drink waitress with the strongly developed moral sense. "You Yanks," she panted, "have no morals." "How so?" "Ah," she said scathingly, "just look at your Hollywood. What, you read about those stars every day, going on with each other the way they do, married 4 and 5 times. They'd be run right out of Australia." "We've still got some morals left." She drew the cover up to her chin. "Not you Yanks. All you want from a girl is to sleep with her." Only a fool, or one no longer interested in the chase, would have pointed to the difficulty of her position. The same evening my homeward steps crossed those of another Marine, younger than I, who grumbled as he sought to remove lipstick smears from the collar of his tunic.
"Trouble with these Australian girls," he complained, "is that they ain't got no morals. They're too easy. Catch an American girl giving herself away like they do. No siree, buddy. They still got morals."
The descendants of the Pharisee are legion. Oh, God, I give thee thanks that I am not as the rest of men, adulterers, as also is this Australian, as also is this American, as also is. It was the drink waitress who was the enigmatic one. As often as I was in her company, I could not comprehend her. She affected to despise Americans, yet, if she did not see me, she saw another Marine. She liked to keep my money, yet, every time I offended her, she pulled it from her purse with an imprecation and gave it back to me. Hot-tempered, she was cold. Drink waitress, she did not like to drink. Scoffer at American music, she would travel miles to a jazz dance. When we went boating on the Yarra, she trailed her hand languidly in the water and seemed so bored that I secretly rejoiced, for we Marines had been getting soft, and the task of rowing upstream had become an ordeal. At last, when she began to yawn, I put the craft about and made for the boathouse. The moment we set foot upon the shore, she wheeled in white anger and blazed at me. "Fancy! Fancy a man like you to take a girl out on the water and bring her back without as much as a sweet look." Next day, my chest and arms throbbed with pain, and I was not rueful that I would not row or see her again. Sheila came back. On a Saturday night when I had to remain in the cricket grounds and had gone to bed early, someone awoke me and said, "There's a girl outside the gate asking for you, Lucky." She had been in Tasmania only a few months, yet she seemed older. We walked in the park and talked. Sheila wanted to go to town, but I told her I could not. Even though she was going back to Tasmania in the morning, I could not.
"But we can't just sit here in the park," she wailed.
"Wait," I said. "I have an idea. The others are on 48-hour passes. I'll get their sleeping pads and blankets and bring them out here. You go get a couple of bottles of beer." I gave her the money. "We'll have a picnic, okay?" She laughed and said, "Yank, you're a bonzer boy." The bunks were darkly silent. I denuded Chuckler's and Hoosier's sacks as well as my own, rolled all up into a huge cylindrical wad, and stumbled out into the park with it. Sheila came along with the beer. As I was spreading out our couch beneath a big tree, we sat on the pads and reached for the beer. I groaned in dismay. She had forgotten to get a bottle opener. "Don't fret, Yank," she said. "Here's a go." And she placed the neck of a quart bottle of Melbourne Bitter to her mouth and bit off the cap. Ah, those Australian girls, I reflected as the wonderful amber fluid came foaming free. "You know, this is a serious offense," she said, making herself comfortable beside me. "It's offending in the King's domain."
"What is that?"
"All public property belongs to the Crown. Something like this is called offending in the King's domain. They can put you in prison for it."
"Bloody good show, eh?"
I teased.
"Poaching, what?"
"Here's a go, Sheila. To His Majesty, the King." We spent the night in the park, and she left me in the morning. Left me when gray dawn drew back the curtain of the night. Left me forever. I gathered the bedding together and stumbled back to the stadium. To my horror, the companies were already forming for reveille outside the wall. With my roll of bedding, I was as inconspicuous as an elephant, a most patent offender in the king's domain. But I resolved to brazen it out. Sinking my face deeply into the bedding, I broke into a half-trot. I shall never forget the look of incredulity that creased the brow of old Gunny when I passed between him and H Company. I had gone but 10 steps or so when a titter broke out, then catcalls, then roars of ridicule. I increased my speed, but it had spread to the other 3 companies, and soon I was running a gauntlet of derision. Running I was, now, with all of my speed, for the shouting and the laughter and the hooting had risen to a gale of sound that blew me through the gate and up the steps to the bunks. If I had offended the king that night, my comrades had exacted ample justice in his behalf. 2. But 2 things might restrain a man in the great debauch: malaria and guard duty. Malaria meant hospital. Sometimes it meant shipment home. So determined were we to enjoy ourselves, though, that a man experiencing the dull, wearing discomfort of an approaching seizure would still go to town. Nor was it uncommon to see such a hardy sensualist huddling against a lamppost, face whitened, teeth chattering, tunic clasped tightly about his shivering body, looking for a taxicab to take him back to camp and a cot in sickbay. That was how I saw Scarchin last. His malarial attacks had become fiercer as they became more frequent. This last time he lay in agony on a cot in sickbay, which was a made-over office beneath the stadium. He had the bone-cracking malaria, the malignant kind that bakes your body in an oven and stretches your bones on a rack. I had come to say goodbye, for I had heard he was to be shipped home. I could not be sure if he had recognized me, nor could I torture him by asking, for such suffering cannot endure the intrusion of another human person. So I took my leave of Scarchin, whom I loved. Scarchin of the sardonic wit and the steady nerve. I held his burning hand and said goodbye. There came, I think, a glint of recognition, a quivering round the mouth, as though he were marshaling those muscles for a smile, but I could not bear to watch him struggle. I dropped his hand and left. For those impervious to malaria, only guard duty could keep us out of the flesh pots. When our battalion had the guard, no matter what company might stand it, we all had to stand by and remain within the cricket grounds. It was like the old days at New River, almost as though life moved again around the old triad of huts, beer, and oil. We would troop in from the drill field and clean up. We would divest ourselves of the long underwear and plunge into the cold showers. Someone would grab the buckets, for beer this time, not oil, while the squad gathered at the foot of the mezzanine overlooking the field. Everyone would be there. Chuckler, Runner, Hoosier, Oakstump, Amish, the Gentleman, plus newcomers like Broadgrin, a wide-shouldered, pleasant-faced lad from the Louisiana bayous who had come in as a replacement on Guadalcanal, and Big Ski, another replacement, tall, rangy, sallow, given to talking out of the side of his mouth about his army hitch in Hawaii and his wife back home. Big Ski was the only married man among us. So we spent the night, sitting in the gathering dark, facing outward to the black puddle of the infield, singing or telling stories, hearing in the lulls the muted voices of other squads. Similarly, spent all around that huge horseshoe enclosing the playing field. The songs we sang were not our own. America had still not given us a song to sing. We borrowed Waltzing Matilda and Bless 'Em All from the Aussies, and I've Got Sixpence from the British, whom we had never seen. Soon, even this mild sport came to an end, and the day that they marched us out to the camp at Dandenong, we knew that the soft times were over. Full marching packs again, helmets clanking against gun barrels, sergeants bellowing again, unable to conceal a certain pleasure, pack straps pulling, cutting into the shoulders, the soft new flesh shrinking, and the veteran shrugging and shifting his load, remembering, desponding. All this again, like a detested acquaintance dropping in for a drink, stirring up old animosities and confiding that he expects he's back in town for good. So make the most of it, and wait for the others to move out.
Company!
There it was.
Hut!
Silence. Just a jot of it. Just that tiny bit of nothingness, devoid of sound or movement, dividing one infinitesimal measure from another, infinity itself, perhaps. And then that unmistakable sound, the soft, shrugging sigh of troops moving in unison, followed by the flat, ragged rap of multitudinous feet upon the pavement, and we were off. My mother told me there'd be days like this, but never so many of them.
Hey, get that machine gun out of my face. What you trying to do, make me a casualty? Keep off my behind then, you jerk, and you won't win no Purple Heart. Yeah, Purple Heart, purple ass, you mean. That's what he'll win.
Dogs by the dozen were marching with us. They raced up and down the line of march, barking playfully. They were so silly and lovable and faithful. We had to laugh at them. A sort of sentimental laugh that moistens the corners of the eyes.
Look at them crazy mutts, said Chuckler. We walk 100 yards and they run a mile. They'll be pooped out before we get halfway there.
He was right. Although he could have shortened the distance. We had not gone 4 miles before I saw the first of them lying exhausted along the roadway. His head was sunk between his paws and his tongue lolled sideways in the dirt. The lower half covered with dust, he watched us sorrowfully as we passed. Poor fellow. He was bushed. For the next mile, the way was littered with canine casualties, but they would not desert us. I stopped feeling sorry for the dogs when I felt the blisters building up on the soles of my feet. They had issued some of us New Zealand Army shoes before the hike, and I was among these unfavored sons of the quartermaster. They were of heavy and astonishingly stiff black leather, with unbending soles and clickety heels. They were not for us. Accustomed as we were to our marine boondockers of buckskin and crepe rubber, a wonderful soft and comfortable shoe designed to make no noise. But this New Zealand instrument of torture, this shoe of steel, this boot of pain, it was working on the soles of my feet with the exquisite delicacy of a vice. Pain became my companion for the next 10 miles, until all of me appeared to be concentrated in this incredible tenderness being pressed at every step against the cruel steel of my shoes. But I made it to our new camp, and when I presented myself to the battalion doctor, and he had examined the great blisters that now hung like udders from the balls of both feet, he said to me, "Should have walked the last 10 miles on your hands." I agreed, and sighed with sensual pleasure as he cut them and let the water run out, bandaged them, and sent me hobbling back to my buddies. I was not the only one who wore those brutal boots. There had been others, similarly afflicted. The shoes were not issued again, for they had come close to ruining the feet of a quarter of the battalion. Our new encampment accommodated the entire 1st Regiment. It was set on the slope of one of the hills, which a land pitifully poor in altitudinous earth has called the Yuyang Mountains. But they were no more than hills, gentle, rolling rises, with here and there a narrow brook. Poor Australia. Here, too, nature has withheld her favors. There are no rivers as we know them, only brooks, and one of them flowed at the foot of the hill on which our tent camp was located. Of course it was raining. And of course there was mud. The food was a slop of mutton and soggy vegetables. For fuel, there was a ration of split logs for the wood-burning stove in the center of each tent. For recreation, there was an occasional weekend liberty, and a slop chute a mile down the road where they served the greenest, foulest beer I have ever drunk. Brewed, I am sure, if the word is not concocted, in the PX officer's own Lister bag, and served to us in our canteen cups in a room fit to hold 20 people, but filled every night with at least 200. The weeks went by in night marches and night problems and daily drill in the fields, no different from the days as a New River recruit, more boring, perhaps even galling, because it was expected of us. the celebrated victors of Guadalcanal. Sometimes we would be issued a handful of rice, or the equivalent of what a Japanese soldier lives on, and be ordered to maneuver at night and make forced night marches of 30 miles or so, and sleep by day. I remember sleeping in a field, and being awakened by a huge, gentle-eyed cow which nuzzled me in a meek reproof for having chosen the tenderest pasture for my couch. From night problems we learned one lasting lesson. When a map and a compass come into contact with a second lieutenant, prepare yourself for confusion. Throughout, there had been an insensible drawing in of discipline, like a rider slowly pulling back on the reins. But there came a sudden rearing halt when they reshuffled the companies. Sergeant McCaustic had taken charge of H Company as first sergeant. He was a slender man, hardly above the minimum height requirement, possessed of filthy tongue, twisted by an openly sadistic temperament, but saved from being a monster by an excellent sense of humor and a quick brain. In Sergeant McCaustic, I had found my personal hair shirt. We had come to an understanding within a day or two, that is, we had agreed that we were incompatible. When the time for reshuffling came, Sergeant McCaustic disposed of me with gleeful dispatch. I expected it as I walked to the company tent with the others at the fateful call. It was raining, but Sergeant McCaustic ignored the raindrops plastering his thin locks against his narrow skull. He spoke with unconcealed glee as he stood there, surrounded by grinning, smirking platoon sergeants and buck sergeants, while the men half encompassed them in a crescent.
All right, here it is. This company's been goofing off long enough, and it's all because of a few eight balls and yard birds, so today we're getting rid of them.
A few of the sergeants held their hands up to their mouths. They were enjoying it. It was obvious that the eight ball list had not been drawn up by McCaustic alone.
I pity the companies that get them. That's all I can say.
McCaustic continued in his rapid way of talking.
But here we go. Following named men are to be shanghaied.
There were snickers.
That is, transferred to E Company. As soon as the name is called, they will return to their squad area, gather up their gear, and fall out in front of the company tent.
Each time he called a name, McCaustic grinned. A sergeant or two would laugh. The mirth would pass from them out to the crescent. But the laughter in the crescent was never so hearty or unfeigned as was that in the sergeant's circle. For each name meant the disgrace of some man, the departure of a buddy, the rending of the fabric of a friendship smelted in Paris Island and New River and tempered in the crucible of Guadalcanal. Each time a name was called, something was lost, something immeasurable. Perhaps not even felt by most of the men in the crescent, but lost nevertheless, like a clod of earth slipping silently off the riverbank and into the current and onto the sea. He called my name. There rose the laughter, and I walked to my tent in grief. Goodbye, Chuckler. So long, Hoosier and Runner. Farewell to H Company. My spirit sank within me. I wept as I walked. And now the rain was merciful, for I could bow my head and pull my helmet low as though to keep it out of my face. I got to my tent and packed my things, but now grief was mingled with humiliation and indignation, and I began to hate Sergeant McCaustic with an unforgiving, unforgetting, unrepentant hatred. My hands hungered for his neck. I yearned to be alone with him in his tent. I burned with the intensity of my hate. And if God himself had bidden me then to love this man, I cannot answer for my reply. I packed and left the tent. It was still raining as I returned to the company tent. The crowd had dispersed. The other Shanghais stood in dejection in the rain, their heads, like mine, sunk lower than was needed to avoid the raindrops, their cringing bodies eloquent of disgrace. Within the company tent, there was a buzz of voices and the cackle of McCaustic's laughter. We stood there until an E Company sergeant appeared. He cast us a lackluster glance and ducked into the tent, reappearing within a few minutes with our record books in his hands. He stuck these beneath his poncho and examined us with candor. He shrugged.
"Detail to shunt,"
he barked. We snapped to clumsily, encumbered by gear.
Right face!
We turned.
Forward arch!
We sloshed away. The Shanghais, or transfers, had gone back and forth between all companies in the battalion, perhaps because the commanders thought that reshuffling would end old family quarrels. In the confusion of it, I sought sanctuary. I decided to go over the hill. But, for once, I would try to get away with it. My plan was thin and involved. It was based on three events of the morning. I had awakened with my upper arms covered with big red weals. The E Company gunnery sergeant had mistaken me for my friend Broadgrin, who had been shanghaied with me. And in a few hours, E Company was to march to Rye for a week of firing weapons. Broadgrin was to remain behind on a wood-chopping detail, as I learned from the gunny. But no one had told him. I got Broadgrin to agree to go out to Rye and to answer my name at Reveille on two mornings. I told him that, when Gunnery Sergeant Straight Talk came around to put me on the wood detail, thinking me Broadgrin, I would tell him who I was and that Broadgrin had gone out to Rye. I would also tell him that I had been ordered to the hospital for treatment of hives. Broadgrin, after 2 days, was to tell the top sergeant at Rye who he was, pretending to be puzzled that his name had not been called at Reveille. He was to say he didn't know me. My hope was that the top sergeant at Rye, once he found that I was absent, would hesitate to enter me as AWOL until he could determine the exact date of my departure. He would not like to admit to either the sergeant major or his company commander that he had been entering an absent man as present. He would wait, I reasoned, until he got back to camp and had the opportunity to pump me. Then I would bluff him. It was a slim chance, but I was desperate to be away from the unknown and unloved faces of my new companions. Broadgrin thought poorly of the plan.
Hell, he said gloomily. If it was me, I'd just take off.
But okay. When E Company marched off to the boondocks, I lay on my cot in the tent. I heard Gunnery Sergeant Straight Talk bellowing in his whiskey bass for the men of the wood detail. I heard him call for Broadgrin twice, and flinched at the ensuing silence. Then Straight Talk bawled out his instructions and commenced his hunt for Broadgrin. I peeped out and saw him clump along the duck walk from tent to tent, sweeping back the flap, peering in, clumping on again. A few tents away, I drew back and lay on my cot. A shaft of daylight preceded Straight Talk into the tent. I closed my eyes.
What the damn hell you doing in your sack?
I opened my eyes, feigned surprise, and jumped to my feet. I looked at him blankly.
Ain't you Broadgrin?
I shook my head silently.
What's your name, then?
Lucky, I said. I came over from H Company.
I know, he mumbled, pulling out a soiled notebook.
Peering at it, he fixed me with a bleary look.
You know Broadgrin?
Yes.
You seen him?
Yes. He went out in the field of the 2nd Platoon. He cursed in exasperation. His breath was fragrant with aqua velva. Sergeant Straight Talk, known the battalion over for his fondness for aftershave lotion, must have drained the bottle that morning. Then he looked fiercely at me.
What the hell are you doing here? Ain't you supposed to be out in the field?
No, I said, rolling up my sleeve.
See?
I've got hives. Top Sergeant told me to go to the hospital. Straight Talk looked at the red welts and recoiled. To an old salt, there was nothing more horrifying than skin disease, any form of bodily uncleanliness. For these are men who have spent a lifetime in communal living and have seen the spread of epidemics. To them, everything is contagious. He left me without further questioning. I put on my liberty clothes, stuffed a few clean khaki shirts and field scarves into a little traveling bag, and lay down again. At noon, while the wood detail was at chow, I retreated down the slope and out the rear of the camp where there were no guards, caught a tram to the Dandenong station, and from there a train to Melbourne. I spent 4 restful days in Melbourne, at the home of a friend, doing the crossword puzzle every morning at Dave's, drinking only a little, reading even, and returned to camp on the fifth day, a Friday. It was payday. A desk had been set up in the company street, behind which sat the company commander, who would pay us once we had signed the payroll book spread out before him.
All right, bellowed Gunnery Sergeant Straight Talk, lapsing into the pay call formula. Line up in alphabetical order, irregardless of rank, regulars first, reserves last. Sign the book, first name, middle initial, and junior if you are one.
I had a premonition. Gunnery Sergeant Straight Talk called my name and surveyed the line with the fierce stare of the huntsman. I stepped forward and signed the payroll. The company commander looked at me steadily, with calm, appraising eyes. He paid me. I sighed with relief and turned, but an angry hand caught my shoulder and spun me.
You lucky?
It was Straight Talk.
Yes?
Get the hell up to the company office. His breath was as redolent of aqua velva as ever, and I reflected, going up to the company office with sinking heart, that today being payday, the battalion PX would undoubtedly be out of shaving lotion by nightfall. I reflected, too, that I had never dealt with the E Company top sergeant before. His anger had no conviction in it as I stood there, looking down at him sitting at his desk. He had not the look of a passionate man, not at all the manner of a hard-boiled top sergeant. His rugged face, with its large nose and larger ears, failed to conceal the fact that he was probably not quite 30, a tender age for a top sergeant in the Marine Corps. You better stay here, he said. You're going to see the man.
Why?
You've got a hell of a nerve asking that. For going AWOL, that's why, and you know it.
Absent without leave, he looked at me sternly.
Where were you?
I remained silent, my heart pounding in my head, hoping that Brodgren had been able to answer one reveille. Just one, that's all, and throw them into confusion.
Where were you? He repeated, not so forcefully.
Out in the field, I said.
He snorted contemptuously.
Don't give me that.
We know you weren't there.
We know what you told the gunny, too. You went over the hill, didn't you?
Silence. His exasperation melted into cajolery, and he showed himself more adept at wheedling than at wrath.
Look, I know what's eating you. I know you got a dirty deal from McCostick. So you got to thinking about it and flipped your lid and went over the hill for a few days. Okay, I don't blame you, maybe. But why don't you be smart? Why don't you admit it and let me talk to the captain? He'll go easy on you. Come on, don't go doing something stupid now and louse yourself up.
This is the appeal most difficult to resist. This is the other fork of the tongue. But I resisted that siren's call and kept silent. Now the top sergeant became petulant. And at last I said, I'm willing to face charges.
Go back to your tent and stand by, he snapped. I made my departure, half exultant. Brodgren must have protected me. Obviously the top sergeant had no wish to bring me before the battalion commander, and this could only be because he was reluctant to admit that he had carried me present on his morning report for some days, when I was in fact AWOL. My scheme was working. I sat in the tent and waited. In an hour, a runner appeared.
Top wants to see you.
Alone, the top sergeant greeted me with a question.
Can you type?
Yes.
Okay. How'd you like to be my company clerk?
Who can blame me if I smiled?
At last I had seen it. If you can't lick 'em, bribe 'em.
I agreed. And 3 days later, the top came down with malaria, and I became the acting first sergeant of E Company. But it was a boring job, hardly less tedious than the duties of company clerk, which I resumed when the top had returned from the hospital. My 10 days of managing E Company were almost without incident, except that once a toady offered me a bribe of £2 to keep him off the weekend guard, which I refused, but which I coerced him into spending on Chuckler, Hoosier, Runner, and the rest when we met one night at the slop shoot. Otherwise, my ludicrous metamorphosis from company culprit into company straw boss provided only exterior comfort. Interiorly, it was a stultifying chore, and that was why I'd leapt at the chance to transfer to battalion intelligence. The artist, who had been in my training platoon at Paris Island, was in battalion intelligence, B2 as it is called. He had been transferred there as a scout from G Company, having distinguished himself at the Battle of the Teneroo, where Jap rashly bayoneted him in the leg. Not long after Top Sergeant had returned, Artis accosted me on the battalion street. Lieutenant Big Picture, the battalion intelligence officer, was with him. "Here he is," he said to the lieutenant, motioning me over. "Here's the man I was telling you about." He introduced me. "I hear you used to be a newspaperman," Big Picture said. I nodded. "How would you like to put out a battalion newspaper?" I was delighted, and so ended my brief and eventful career as an E-Company rifleman, during which I never once shouldered a rifle. Of course, I never came close to publishing a battalion newspaper either. It was merely one of Big Picture's big ideas. It was a notion that flattered his vanity. There was not even a regimental or divisional newspaper. Still, Big Picture might boast of having a potential publisher in his intelligence section, might even, this being his nature, consider the wish to be a fact. Even so, Big Picture rescued me from the drudgery of the company office, brought me back to the field, and assuaged the pride wounded by my caustic Shanghai. I owe it to Big Picture, also, that he cared nothing for my reputation as a rebel, not even that by then I was already a veteran brig rat. Chapter 5. Brig Rat. 1. I have heard it said that General Smedley Butler was fond of observing, "Give me a regiment of brig rats, and I'll lick the world." It may be that old Gimlet Eye never said this, but it is exactly the sort of thing he might have said, or, if not he, then many another Marine commander. For it is most especially a Marine sentiment, and when analyzed, it turns out not to be shameless or shocking, but merely this: a man who lands in the brig is apt to be a man of bold spirit and independent mind, who must occasionally rebel against the harsh and unrelenting discipline of the camp. I am not attempting to exalt what should be condemned. I am not suggesting that because of their boldness or independence the brig rats be forgiven or escape punishment. Brig they must be, and brig they were. Nor am I speaking of the habitual brig rat, the steady malingerer, the good-for-nothing who is more often in the brig than out of it, and who seeks to avoid every consequence of his uniform, even fighting. I speak of the young, high-hearted soldier whose very nature is bound to bring him into conflict with military discipline and to land him, unless he is exceptionally lucky, in the brig. I speak of Chuckler, and Chicken, and Oakstump, and a dozen others. And, of course, of myself. George Washington's birthday was the day on which Chuckler and I smudged the purity of our record books. The division was to parade in Melbourne that day. We were to march up Swanston Street, hardly a month after our arrival in Australia, to accept the plaudits of a city and nation still mindful of the Jap threat that had existed on Guadalcanal. But Chuckler and I did not want to march. We wanted to see the parade, and this, you will understand, is quite impossible to the person who marches in it, rifle glued to the shoulder, eyes straight ahead and unswervingly focused on the nape of the forward fellow's neck. By some subterfuge, we evaded this odious duty, and so it was that we were firmly entrenched outside the City Club, drinks in hand, when the 1st Marine Division marched in Melbourne on the afternoon of February 22, 1943. Around us rose the cheerful and delighted calls of the Australians, as our comrades swung past. "Good on ye, Yank! Ah, a bonza bunch indeed! Good old lads! Hurrah for the Yankee lads!" The men wore field uniforms, combat packs, and full combat dress. Rifles were slung and bayonets fixed. Each man wore or carried the weapon which was his in battle. So they were impressive. Lean, hard, tanned, clean-limbed and capable-looking. I swallowed frequently, and my eyes were moist as they passed by. Even the Australians, who have inherited the British fondness for heel-clicking, arm-swinging, strutting troops, even they finally fell silent at the noiseless passage of the 1st Marine Division, walking in that effortless yet wary way that marks the American fighting man moving to the front. Soon, Chuckler sighted the waving red and gold banner of our regiment. We ducked out of sight, moving from our front row position back to the 3rd or 4th. The 1st Battalion swung by, then came ours, and our hearts beat faster. E Company, F Company, now, at last, H Company. There they were! They were Hoosier and Runner, Lieutenant Ivy League and the Gentleman and Amish, all of them. Oh, what a proud sight. It was exhilarating. It was heady. It was as good as reading your own obituary or hearing your own funeral oration to see them move so confidently and so proudly along and to mark the admiration in the eyes of the Australians around us. Great day indeed. We hoped it would never end. But it did, and there was nothing left to do but to substitute for this rare and genuine exhilaration that other artificial sort which is kept, corked and capped, an inexhaustible supply within bottles. So we turned around and re-entered the city club. And, of course, we drank too much. By nightfall, we had had it. But Chuckler was due to stand guard at the slop chute that night. He took his leave, wavering slightly. But by the time he arrived at the cricket grounds, I was sure the waver would be gone. Chuckler had that faculty. After a time, I too returned to camp, arriving there only by luck or the intercession of my guardian angel. I ran for a tram speeding up Wellington Parade, leapt for the platform, missed it, grabbed the handrail, and was dragged for 2 blocks until a pair of strong-armed diggers were able to pull me aboard like a drowning man. Wavering, I came erect and thrust out my chest. "That's nothing," I said. "Last night, I got hit by one." There was laughter until I reached my stop and got off. I found Chuckler standing glumly outside the slop chute entrance. He had hoped for interior guard, where he might sneak a beer or two. "I'll get you one," I promised. I returned with a big glass seidel, out of which Chuckler might take a surreptitious sip. There were more seidels, until Chuckler said, "I gotta go to the head. Here, cover for me." He gave me his pistol belt and helmet, and made off. For a sentry to be drunk, and then to desert his post and surrender his weapon, is to combine cardinal sin with unforgivable offense. I was anxiously hoping that he would hurry back, but then an unfortunate thing happened. Lieutenant Ivy League came striding down the corridor. I say it was unfortunate because Ivy League was the officer of the day. More than that, he was still the man who had filched my cigars. The enlisted men's cigars, if you will. My anger was nourished by the alcohol within me, and I drew Chuckler's pistol and pointed it at him and said, "Stop where you are, you lousy cigar-stealing son of a bitch, or I'll blow your gentleman's ass off." Or words to that effect. Whatever the phraseology, the pistol made the point. Lieutenant Ivy League retreated, returning reinforced by the corporal of the guard, Smoothface, who had rejoined the regiment, and the sergeant of the guard. While Ivy League engaged me in conversation, Smoothface and the sergeant were infiltrating. Suddenly they sprang. I had been outwitted. Now I was overpowered. "Get that pistol and pistol belt," ordered Ivy League, white with rage. "Now find that damn fool Chuckler." There was no need. He came hurrying up. Too late, alas. Ivy League ordered him imprisoned. Quivering with fury, his hands clenching and unclenching, his lantern jaw so tautly set one could almost hear the molars grinding, Ivy League surveyed us. Then, "Brigham!" Smoothface led us away. Unaccountably, as we neared the forbidding steel cage facade of the brig, we were given a reprieve. The sergeant said something and Smoothface halted. "Go on up to your sacks," he said. "Ivy League see y'all in the morning." He shook his head sadly, especially sorrowful as his gaze fell upon me.
I don't know what the damn hell's got into y'all. Licky, trying to shoot the OD. I know a guy got 10 years just for socking an officer.
Someone awakened me roughly in the morning. It was the sergeant of the night before. Come on, get your clothes on. Full green, you're going to see the man.
He stood bleakly by as I hastily covered my long underwear with battle jacket and trousers. The sergeant might be bleak exteriorly, but I was positively frozen interiorly. What I had done the preceding night was now upon me. 20 years at hard labor would not be too severe punishment for assaulting the officer of the day. Frostier than either of us, the battalion sergeant major awaited us outside the colonel's door. Tall, sharp-featured, his sandy hair thinning and the hairs of his military mustache bristling like bayonets, he seemed more a sergeant of Scots Guards than American Marines. "The prisoner," he said, looking through me, heedless of my horror upon hearing myself so described. "The prisoner will enter the colonel's office when I give the order. Upon the command to halt, he will come to attention before the colonel and remain there until dismissed. Attention, forward arch! Prisoner, halt!" My eyes fell upon the pink, bald pate of Mr. 5x5, our battalion commander. Mr. 5x5 got his nickname from his build. A few inches over 5 feet in height, and almost that much in breadth. It was an affectionate nickname, and we were really fond of him. Or at least had been on Guadalcanal, when not a day passed that did not bring Mr. 5x5 toiling up and down those mountain ridges to look over his lines and his men. Now the sergeant major was reading the charges, the crispness of his military style occasionally defeated by a difficulty with words. Then he had finished, and the colonel looked up and through me, as though my stomach were transparent. "Lieutenant, let's hear your version of what happened."
Ivy League's voice came floating over my shoulder. I felt Mr. 5x5's eyes upon me while Ivy League, talking in a strained voice, as though either he, too, were abashed by the colonel, or else he were reluctant to do what he had to do, related the night's events. He told the truth, including that most important piece of evidence, the fact that I had been drinking, for drunkenness goes a long way toward mitigating an offense in the Marine Corps. The colonel studied me sternly. I stared ahead, trying not to swallow, trying to put steel into my stature, trying to keep from blinking, trying to keep my tongue moist, so that I might answer quickly and clearly when spoken to, trying in every way to raise a false strength upon the sinking sands of my craven stomach. The colonel's manner was stern. I could learn nothing from his face, while he studied my record book, leafing the pages slowly, seeming to weigh these against the words of the sergeant major and of Ivy League. Would he be cruel or kind? I could not tell, but I knew this, as every soldier knows in war. My future, my life, even, was his to dispose of. It is a most unsettling thought.
"How do you plead?"
Against my will, I cleared my throat and swallowed. "Guilty, sir." He studied the book again. He raised his gaze and held my eyes. "I'm not going to ruin your life," he said, and my stomach that had been fleeing seemed to pause and turned. "I could put you away for a long time for what you've done. Being drunk is no excuse. A Marine is supposed to be able to handle his liquor. You've got a good war record, though." He went on, leafing the pages of my record book again. "And you seem to have a good background, so I'm not going to ship you back to Portsmouth, where the book says I should ship you. But I'm not going to let you get away with it either." His face hardened. "5 days bread and water. Reduce to private." The sergeant major's command snapped out. I obeyed mechanically, so happy I almost missed the look of chagrin on Ivy League's face, the look of the hunter whose prey had eluded him. Ivy League did not want to ruin me either, but he would have appreciated a stiffer sentence. 5 days bread and water? I could have got 5 years. I was elated and could have hugged the prison chaser when he appeared outside the colonel's office, rifle at port arms, and escorted me away. Going to the brig in the Marine Corps, especially to the bread and water cell. It's like going abroad. First you must go to sickbay for a physical examination to determine if you are strong enough to stand such a diet and confinement. Then you must visit the company office to have the black marks entered in your record, and more important, to be sure you are docked in pay for the time you spend imprisoned. Next, you must revisit your company area to surrender your weapon and your gear to your property sergeant, and then, clad only in baggy, faded dungarees, the livery of the brig, you are ready for the door to clang shut behind you. Back in your company, you are a dead man for 5 days. Even your bunk is denuded of pad and blankets. You are a cipher, the scapegrace whose picture is turned to the wall. Every foot of the way, in these progressions made at an odd, dog-like pace, there follows your prison chaser, trotting grimly behind, his rifle at high port, like a canoeist with paddle poised. Your shadow and your shame. The large black circles adorning front and back of your costume are almost endowed with weight. You feel them so poignantly, for you know that these are there for the prison chaser to aim at, should you break for freedom. The brig receives you, and you are nothing. Even the clothes you wear belong to the brig and bear its mark. Your very belt and razor blades have been entrusted to the brig warden. You have nothing. You are nothing. The steel cage door clangs behind you. Oh, cipher, and there is the brig warden standing there, suggestively flexing a length of rubber hose, and you realize that he has been chosen for his cruelty. Suddenly things have become serious. There is no one to appreciate the humor of the situation. A chill rises from the cement floor, and the heart within you freezes, gazing upon the brig warden with the cruelty shining from his black eyes. It is cold, and you are alone. And there against you stands the brig warden in his neatly pressed uniform, and behind him the United States Marines, and behind them the United States of America, and behind the brig warden again, in all reality, a door is opening and a voice commands, "Forward, march," and you walk in on stilts to greet your companions in the bread and water cell. I had entered a shadowy world. I had entered a place that seemed a cavern, hollowed out of the submarine rock of a subterranean river. But then I heard the murmur of voices, and the shadows seemed to take on substance. And I heard a laugh. And then even this foul place seemed to brighten with that great flaming thing, the human spirit. And I realized, of course, that I was not in hell at all, but only in the brig for 5 days. My eyes having adjusted to the gloom, I found myself in a room about 20 feet by 15, into which a murky light sneaked through a rectangle of thick glass high in one wall. The floor was of bare cement, as were the walls, and it sloped inward toward a drain set in the center. In the middle of the right-hand wall was a water tap, on which hung 2 or 3 metal canteen cups. The bread and water cell was a converted shower room, I noticed now, that my shadows were leaning against the walls, regarding me with curiosity and expectation. A voice questioned from the murk, "What are you in for?" I swallowed and answered. There was an awesome silence. Then, "What are you, crazy man? What do you want to try to shoot the OD for?" "He stole my cigars on Guadalcanal," somebody growled. "Too bad he didn't kill the bastard." And another asked, "What'd they give you?" "5 days bread and water," I answered. This time there was a general ejaculation of disbelief. "How'd you get away with it? Hell, I got 30 days P&P just for going over the hill a couple of days, and you only get 5? For what you did? They should have shipped you back to Portsmouth and brigged your ass forever." "Hell yes, trying to shoot the OD? Who do you know, fella? Your old man a general or something?" Suddenly a rifle butt smacked sharply on the door. "Quiet in there!" There was a low grumbling, and gradually silence fell upon the bread and water cell. My eyes were now fully accustomed to the bad light, and I studied my fellow brig rats. There was no one from my company, although I saw other men from the battalion whom I knew by sight. Every face seemed disfigured by that look of peevish dejection, common to victims of petty persecution, or to city youth or to disenchanted dilettantes. But not one but was mitigated by the suggestion that, let the prison gates fly open, and every trace of rancor or resentment would vanish. Apart from that look, aside from vain grumbling against the officers or NCOs who had landed them there, or direful but empty threats of vengeance, there was nothing to distinguish the brig rats from the men on the outside. They were merely Marines who had got into trouble. The shadows still stood. No one sat. And I asked a man close to me why. He pointed to the floor and said, "They wet the deck. You can't sit down unless you want a wet behind." The floor was wet, and just then, the door flew open and a private began sloshing buckets full of water on the floor. Behind him stood another private, with rifle at high port. I felt myself go hot with anger. "Take it easy," said the shadow beside me. "You'll get used to it. The brig ain't no country club, you know. They wet the deck whenever they catch somebody smoking in here."
"Smoking?"
He nodded, and I followed his eyes. Hardly had the door closed on the bucket-wielding private before two shades huddled opposite us lighted a blackened cigarette butt. They concealed the match flare by taking off both of their dungaree coats and placing them, like a tent, over the head of one of them. They smoked by inhaling little bursts, expelling them quickly downward, and then dissipating the telltale clouds by quick, fan-like movement of the hands. It was a caricature, but no one thought it funny. There were fierce whispers of displeasure, but the smokers ignored them, continuing to jeopardize the entire room for a pleasure that could derive only from the knowledge that they were breaking a rule. Certainly the way they smoked could not be pleasant. "They're long-termers," the shade beside me explained. "They've each got about 20-25 days more to do. They don't care if they get caught now. A few more days don't mean anything to them. That's how they get the cigarettes," he went on. "Long-termers get a full meal every fourth day. When they march them down to chow with the regular straight-time prisoners, somebody slips them a cigarette. They smuggle it in by sticking it in their hair or between their fingers, or even in their mouth. They wait until it dries out." The door flew open again, and I cringed, expecting more water. But it was mealtime.
"Rookie, rookie, rookie, come and get your chow,"
one of the guards chanted in a mock falsetto. Then he slid a big wooden box into the middle of the room and slammed the door. They fell upon it like ravening wolves. They leapt upon that box and tore at the loaves of bread within it with the fury of a mob plucking at the flesh of a fallen tyrant. With a single soundless bound, they pounced upon it and wrestled and shoved and pulled until, each with a handful of bread crammed against his lips, they fell back against the wall, there to crouch like caged animals, munching wordlessly on their fodder, their eyes angry and suspicious, their shoulders hunched and their very bodies suggestive of a snarl. Occasionally, a shade would rise to his feet and draw a cup of water from the tap, or take a pinch of salt from the grain spilled carelessly in the bottom of the box. This was bread and water. It was repeated morning, noon, and night, and I, who had stood off in horror when that first shattering leap had come, I found only a crust or so to reward my revulsion. Thereafter, I learned to leap upon the first syllable of the guard's mocking chant. Night falls in the brig, with the swift, silent plunge of dark dropping on the jungle. There is no dusk. A last feeble ray of light dies in the air about you, and suddenly it is pitch dark. Suddenly, too, you are tired. The evening breadbox has been and gone. There is nothing to expect, but the passage of a day and the approach of freedom. Better to sleep, to forget it, to pass the night in soft and blissful oblivion, and to awake one day nearer release. The guards appear with the blankets, two to a man, one to place between body and the still damp concrete, the other for a cover. Like Robin Hood's men, we throw ourselves upon this rude couch and go to sleep. We, the prisoners, are more fortunate than our jailers, for while we sleep, a guard must stand among us. We repose in the hollow of the hand of God. Even we prisoners do this, and our guard must stand sleepless and erect, wary and fretful even, that some prisoner may outwit him and escape. But we sleep. Morning brings the melancholy. We stand or crouch, faceless and formless, waiting for the breadbox, longing for the night and dreading the dawn, counting the days and cursing the explosion of time, the eruption of minutes into hours and hours into days and four little days into an error, hating the officers and inventing impossible means of vengeance, sinking, sinking, sinking so deep into the abyss of self-pity that soon the very world is thrown out of balance and blankets and breadbox become magnified beyond proportion, occupying a man's whole mind, usurping the dwelling place of the world by a process of inverse mysticism that destroys time in reverse, that is the very black and evil heart of despair. But there is a morning that brings freedom. The prison chaser trots behind again. There are the visits to the sick bay and the company office, and then release. The steel cage door clangs behind. Behind are the melancholy inmates of the bread and water cell, ciphers once again, their faces featureless and irretrievable. The thing has left its mark. 5 little days even, and there is a scar. There is the memory of a debasing thing to be shared with all birds whose wings have been clipped, with all caged beasts and imprisoned vagrants, with the lowest and the highest in the history of time. Yet a man who is getting out of the brig, in which he has been imprisoned for the first time, if such a man has spirit and the sense to profit by misfortune, a man like this will turn and gaze upon the place and smile. Then he will laugh. Because who can hurt him now? He's had bread and water. Chuckler was awaiting summary court-martial when I got out, and his counsel called me as a defense witness. Runner, too, was to appear as a character witness. All three of us were filled with fear when the day of trial came. Chuckler, because of the gravity of his offense and the possibility that he might be remanded to the far graver trial of a general court-martial. Runner, because his loyalty to Chuckler might lead him to an inadvertent disclosure of his own sins. Myself, for the same reason, fortified by the fact that I had already tasted the brig. We were fearful, too, because at first glance, the court seemed such a travesty of justice. I say at first glance, for from its makeup and its conduct, such it would seem to have been, yet it was no such thing at all, for it ended in a finding that was as just as it was practical. A lawyer might still insist that Chuckler's court was a travesty. A lawyer might be convulsed with mirth by Chuckler's counsel, a brand new second lieutenant, younger even than we, fresh from an uncompleted pre-law course in a New York City college, most obviously destined to be a politician rather than a pleader. A lawyer would sneer at the prosecution and the judges, all chosen from the ranks of lieutenants and captains who had but 2 years ago been college boys of no more pressing judgments to make than to decide whether or not to spend the weekly allowance on beer or books. Such was Chuckler's court. But it ended by reducing him from corporal to private and giving him 10 days in the straight-time brig. No one, least of all Chuckler, could dispute such a wise and merciful sentence. It is unfortunate that my memory is so miserably unproductive here. I wish I could recall more of that trial. Once, I remember, the prosecution halted Chuckler's counsel as he questioned me on my friendship for the defendant. "That's a leading question," the prosecutor snapped, whereupon the defense counsel, at first startled that this typical courtroom phrase should be turned against him, the only man in the room of legal training, gathered his facial muscles together in a crushing look of contempt and continued his interrogation. The judges, all too aware of the defense counsel's legal talent, uncrossed and recrossed their legs, fluttered their hands, and let the objection die. So Chuckler lost his chevrons, and drew 10 days in the comparative comfort of the straight-time brig. And his only complaint when he finally emerged was that